The next case is 06-2072, Lucian Pruszynski versus Sarah Reeves. Mr. Schlesinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'll be splitting my time evenly with John Pfau, who's counsel for the other appellants, the Kaufmans, and we would like to reserve a total of 4 minutes for rebuttal. We submit that the 11th District Court of Appeals committed reversible error in awarding prejudgment interest to the Pruszynskis when the trial court had not conducted a hearing on their motion for prejudgment interest. A motion for prejudgment interest may be denied by a trial court without conducting a hearing. Conversely, however, a motion for prejudgment interest cannot be granted unless the trial court has already conducted a motion, or excuse me, a hearing on that motion.
Counsel, could you help us out? In the Court of Appeals, you argued the opposite, did you not?
Respectfully, no. In the Court of Appeals, the issue at the trial court level was whether or not prejudgment interest was applicable. The Pruszynskis filed a motion, and the trial court denied it without holding a hearing.
But you argued no hearing is necessary.
We argued to the Court of Appeals a hearing is discretionary if that motion for prejudgment interest is going to be denied.
So if you're going to win, the court doesn't have to have a hearing, but if you're going to lose, they have to have a hearing. A hearing, because hearing means a lot of things. Hearing, the term hearing appears all over the code. Let's take probate, for example. There are all kinds of hearings called for. The day comes and goes, and staff puts the necessary stamps on the papers, and that's the hearing. Hearing doesn't necessarily, I'm unaware of where in the code it says hearing means that two lawyers have to be in front of a judge arguing.
And yes, Your Honor, the courts of appeals decisions that have addressed what type of hearing is required, most of those courts of appeals have consistently said that it has to be an evidentiary oral hearing. And that makes sense because, like in this case, the Pruszynskis submitted evidence in support of their motion for prejudgment interest. But by all accounts, as set forth in their brief, that evidence was not complete. The insurance companies had not submitted complete claims files post-judgment, and one of the insurance companies actually filed a motion for a protective order. So what that trial court then was facing at that quote-unquote hearing would have been simply the briefs of the Pruszynskis as well as the briefs of the defendants. It was an incomplete record at that point. If a oral evidentiary hearing had been conducted.
How did the Court of Appeals know so much about what was in the claims files if the trial court didn't have that information?
There was information submitted attached to the Pruszynskis' motion for prejudgment interest that included parts of the claims files that, of course, they highlighted the parts that helped their case. If a hearing...
And your side didn't?
We certainly opposed the motion, but we fully expected, pursuant to Revised Code 1343.03c, that if that motion was going to be granted, we were going to be afforded a full and fair opportunity to present evidence at an evidentiary hearing. At that point, we would have been able to submit the entire parts of the claims files. We would have been able to submit testimony from the insurance adjusters and possibly testimony from the attorneys themselves who were involved in the pretrial settlement negotiations. This court has consistently found over the past several years that it is the trial court which must hold a hearing on prejudgment interest if it's going to be granted. That's the Gelmisch decision, Lovewell, and then Moskowitz.
So your argument is really pretty simple. I mean, I know the other side tries to argue inconsistencies, but I don't see inconsistencies. It's just that the Court of Appeals is limited to finding abuse of discretion. And its role then is limited to remanding it, at which the trial court then holds the hearing. And the trial court takes the evidence. And that's what several courts of appeals have done in these type of cases. And your objection is that this trial court didn't even have any hearing, just decided on the record, and that its only role was to find was there abuse of discretion in denying and then remanding it for a hearing? Is that basically your position?
That's exactly it, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals in this case did not have a complete record before it when it decided that the insurance companies had acted in bad faith and the
Brzezinski's
had acted.
And they could go back for that hearing and you could lose and pay the full interest.
We have no idea what will happen if the trial court conducts a full hearing. It's quite possible the same result will be reached. However, we have to be afforded that opportunity at the trial court level to be able to present the additional evidence.
Well, counsel, would you like us to make a rule here that comports with what your position in the briefs is, that a trial judge can deny prejudgment interest without hearing? Is that, I mean, yeah. You'd like to see that as a proclamation from the Supreme Court?
Yes, Your Honor. Within the trial court's discretion, the trial judge should be able to deny the motion if he or she knows at that point that the motion's going to be denied. We've got a trial judge.
And yet, in order to get prejudgment interest, you have to have a complete record before the judge and an oral hearing. An evidentiary hearing plus a complete record.
That is our position, Your Honor, because
So the judge then has enough information from having conducted the trial to deny the hearing, but doesn't have enough information from conducting a trial and the pretrials to grant prejudgment interest. That's what you're saying.
That's correct. The insurance companies have to be afforded an opportunity, if that motion is going to be granted, to get in all parts of their claims files as well as testimony from their insurance adjusters as well as the attorneys, if
necessary.
Don't
you think the plaintiffs, the prevailing party, should have the same opportunity at a prejudgment interest hearing?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and if I wasn't making that clear, that's my mistake. The purpose of the hearing is to entitle both sides to present evidence in support of and also in opposition to a motion for prejudgment interest. But the trial judge that we're dealing with, he or she has sat through the trial, has sat through the pretrial settlement negotiations, and if he or she already has made up in his or her mind that prejudgment interest is not going to be granted, it doesn't make sense for him to have a hearing on the record, have everybody...
But what if there was information in the record that the trial judge did not know about the settlement negotiations and all of the offers made? That would be very pertinent. I mean, I understand your argument on that this appellate court shouldn't have decided it because it's an abuse of discretion, should go back down. But again, I know we have some case law that seems to imply that you don't have to have a hearing if you deny it, but maybe that's not the fair position. I mean, what if there is information in the file the trial judge is not privy to that says, you know, they knew a lot of facts and they made settlement offers, knowing these facts could really give them a large verdict and they still ignored them?
Well, and I think that has to be a concern, but this court has found that the trial judge is afforded discretion in making that ruling on a motion for prejudgment interest, whether or not the hearing has to be conducted, and if it does have to be conducted, whether or not there was good faith versus bad faith negotiations between the parties. At this point, I've used up a good part of my time. I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Pfau. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schlesinger. Mr. Pfau.
May it please the court, John Pfau on behalf of the appellants. And to follow on with Mr. Schlesinger's argument, the body of Court of Appeals case law, in conjunction with the prior Supreme Court case law on this issue, there have been a variety of issues where it's been determined that a trial court, having tried the case, dealt with all the negotiations, made the rulings throughout the entire thing, sits in a special position where the trial court can determine often if there's no basis for prejudgment interest and a motion isn't well taken. And this body of cases has held that under those circumstances, a trial court can deny a motion for prejudgment interest without a hearing. The statute
Do we have an Ohio Supreme Court that specifically says that?
Not a Supreme Court case, Your Honor, and that's correct. It's the Supreme Court cases have held that part of the process, the four-step process of getting prejudgment interest, requires the moving party to file a motion, and in order for the court to grant it, The statute says there must be a hearing. The statute does not say in order to deny it there must be a hearing. So I believe it's mandatory based just on the language of the statute that you must have a hearing.
Well, counsel, how does this different from all the other references in the code to hearing, where hearings is, I mean, your definition of a hearing today is two lawyers representing opposing sides in front of a judge, calling witnesses if they choose, submitting documents, a trial. But the code is full of references to hearings where that doesn't happen.
In this particular case, there was no hearing, no non-oral hearing, no hearing of any sort held, or even indicated that it was going to proceed. What, and now to answer your question, Your Honor, I think it has been carved out through the case law and the way this prejudgment interest statute has progressed through practicality that, in fact, it's generally accepted that there is an evidentiary hearing held, and that's the way it's been done and the way the various cases have indicated it should proceed. I agree the definition of hearing could involve different things than an evidentiary hearing. I think in this particular instance, the courts have carved out that with prejudgment interest, it isn't a ministerial type ruling, that it is something where you need a broad scope of evidence.
What are we going to find the judge had in front of him?
Without a hearing?
When the judge made the decision.
Yeah. Well, the judge had things certainly the Court of Appeals didn't have. The Court of Appeals didn't have a transcript of proceedings. They don't know what happened in the trial court. They came up with ideas what happened, but they didn't read a transcript.
I didn't ask you what they didn't have. I asked you what the
trial judge had.
What the trial judge
did
have.
The trial judge had everything. He had sat through the trial, so he had all the evidence. He had been at pretrial negotiations. He had all of the pleadings, all of the depositions. He had dealt with the parties throughout. So he had all of the information. He had also had bits and pieces of the claims files and that sort of thing. He didn't have testimony from the claims person.
Did he have briefs from the parties?
He had briefs. He had
on this issue?
A motion for prejudgment interest. He had response briefs.
What evidence did you submit in response to the motion for prejudgment interest?
We submitted, and I didn't handle the trial, but we submitted a brief in response, and there was anticipation that there would be a evidentiary hearing because the other side had requested the files and the depositions of the people, so we anticipated ultimately presenting evidence. We did not present evidence per se because we anticipated doing that at the hearing.
Is there a local rule in the trial court? Does it have a local rule regarding hearings? You know, sometimes you have to request an oral or an evidentiary hearing, or the court will decide it based upon the filings. Is there such a rule in this county?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And there was a request made for an oral hearing in this matter as well.
Mr. Fowle, you had referred to the rule, and just in short, it says if upon motion regarding prejudgment interest, the court determines at a hearing held subsequent to the verdict that the party required to pay, and then it goes on to how to compute. Doesn't that suggest that if there's a motion filed, the court is to hold a hearing? Because we're talking about a mini case, really the efforts to settle between the parties and whether there was good faith or bad faith. So it's something that is very evidentiary intensive. Doesn't C1 suggest that no matter what the court is going to do, it should give the parties the opportunity to present this evidence?
I agree that it discusses a hearing. I think strictly read, it indicates if the court is going to grant the motion, it must be done at a hearing. But I agree certainly that the statute requires that a hearing proceed before the motion can be granted.
Oh, counsel, you said there was a hearing here. It just wasn't an oral hearing.
No, there was no hearing. There was no non-oral hearing. There was no hearing, no evidentiary hearing. There was a request for an oral hearing, but no hearing of any sort.
So the next thing everybody knows once the information is submitted to the court is that there's a judgment entry saying motion denied.
Correct. It said motion for prejudgment interest was not well taken.
Were you surprised?
You know, I just got into the case after that. I guess
don't have to answer.
I was pleased, but not surprised.
The rule for summary judgment also calls for a hearing, doesn't it?
Correct.
But no judge in Ohio really conducts a hearing on a motion for summary judgment. That is an evidentiary. They don't schedule time for a presentation of evidence, exhibits, or testimony on summary judgment. It's pretty customary. Those are determined on the pleadings by judges, even though the rule says there'd be a hearing.
That's correct. And I again, if you read Rule 56, it doesn't talk about the type of hearing or that a hearing must actually proceed. All it talks about is that before a hearing, affidavits, evidence, depositions must be
correct.
Submitted. And I think that has developed in Ohio into a non-oral hearing type situation to comply with the statute. So do I
understand your argument correctly that the hearing contemplated here is only necessitated by statute or by rule if it's to be granted?
But well,
the court holds the discretion to deny it.
Right. That's what the statute says. It says in order to grant the motion, you have to proceed with the hearing. That's what the statute says, so that is our position.
Thank you.
With that, I will sit down and reserve our time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Potter.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, your honors, I am Stephen Potter, and I represent the appellees in this case. The Court of Appeals was engaged in exactly what each of the appellants wanted it to do, determine whether, based on the evidence before it in the record of this case, the trial court abused its discretion in determining whether the appellants had failed to make a good faith effort to settle the case.
Well, that's not the legal issue. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, Mr. Potter, do we have to determine what a hearing actually is in this case?
Not based upon what the Court of Appeals did in this particular case. The Court of Appeals looked at both assignments of error. There were two assignments of error that the Prusinskis asserted with the Court of Appeals. One, that in fact the trial court erred in denying the motion for prejudgment interest without a hearing, and two, and that's the second issue, is the one in which the court ultimately ruled, is whether the trial court abused its discretion in denying the motion for prejudgment interest. And that's what the Court of Appeals did. It examined the record in this case.
But if the Court of Appeals found it was abuse of discretion, why would it not remand? Because no hearing had been held, and there could be more evidence that was going to be presented by both sides at a hearing that was anticipated, obviously, by both sides. Yet the court went to a final judgment without the benefit of the hearing, which seems to be in direct contradiction to the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that all the parties anticipated that there was going to be an oral hearing. One of the prime reasons that...
Well, wasn't your client still seeking further evidence, further depositions, further documents from the insurance companies, and those motions were pending for protective orders, and they were simply ignored and therefore assumed denied?
We were seeking additional remnants of the claims files from one of the insurer's files. Yet, because the practice almost universally throughout most of these counties is that you submit these types of motions, or often submit these types of motions, like a summary judgment motion, on briefs with evidentiary materials attached, in an abundance of caution, we submitted substantial evidentiary materials. And each of the appellants in this case had the opportunity to respond to to the motion, to the briefs, to the evidentiary materials that were submitted. We requested an oral hearing. That request was obviously not granted. Requests can be made in a motion for summary judgment for
an counsel,
oral hearing.
Counsel, what you're saying then, the appellate court's de novo review of all the information that was submitted to the trial court had to assume that all the evidence, that was all the evidence there was going to be on this issue, that that was, even if both parties had anticipated an oral argument with discovery to have taken place, or at least an exchange of information, some type of discovery was necessary in order to prepare for the oral argument that would be had in this matter. And instead, the appellate court just took all of the evidence that was in the record, a limited amount of evidence, and did a de novo review and said, based on all this, we go through the 4 points of when it's appropriate to grant, and we award prejudgment interest.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that the Court of Appeals conducted a de novo review. In its opinion, it specifically indicates that the standard was an abuse of discretion, and the specific assignment of error upon which the Court of Appeals was analyzing this particular case was whether the court, the trial court, abused its discretion in not granting, in denying the motion for a prejudgment interest. And that's the substance of the opposition in the Court of Appeals.
Well, they could have found, yes, they abused their discretion. Let's send it back and have a do-over. Instead, they go ahead, analyze all the components that were necessary legally to award prejudgment interest and say prejudgment interest is appropriate here.
Yes, that is one option that the Court of Appeals could have engaged.
That's not a de novo review of this matter?
Well, I think that that's one option that the Court of Appeals could have engaged in. And in order to determine whether there's an abuse of discretion, the court has to look at the body of the evidence. In Moskowitz, this court did the same thing. It looked at the entire body of the evidence, and it didn't remand the case for an evidentiary hearing. It indicated that prejudgment interest should be granted, and it remanded the matter back to the trial level just for a computation as to the amount of that prejudgment interest, exactly what the Court of Appeals did in this case.
Do you agree that a trial court only need hold an oral evidentiary testimonial presentation hearing if it intends to grant the motion?
No, I do not agree with that, Your Honor.
May a court deny prejudgment interest without such a proceeding, in your view?
Well, in my view, no. Under the case law, Your Honor, there's a body of case law from several of the courts of appeals that indicates when the motion is obviously not well taken. And I think that's the key word, obviously not well taken.
If I understand Mr. Faw's position, he claims that the statute says a hearing for oral presentation of evidence is only required if the motion is to be granted.
I don't think the statute says that at all, Your Honor. I think that's, with all due respect to Mr. Fowle, an unfair reading of the statute.
Is it your position that in every instance a motion for prejudgment interest is filed, a trial judge must conduct an evidentiary proceeding?
Well, not in every instance, because there are certain prerequisites. You must file the motion within the specified period of time. I think that you have to at least establish the prima facie case in your motion, meeting the elements of the statute and the elements as set forth in Moskowitz, the components of the statute, that you file within the appropriate time limit, that there has been a judgment that's been rendered by the trial court, that the party that has to pay the money did engage in good faith settlement efforts, and that the party to whom the money is to be paid didn't fail to respond in kind and in good faith.
Anytime such a motion is made in the court, your view is the trial judge must conduct an evidentiary proceeding on the record.
I think if we're to establish, and I think that's different from this case, but if we're to establish bright line rules to guide litigants, their counsel, and judges, I think that makes a lot of sense. That's not this particular case, but going forward, if this court were to adopt such rule, I think it makes sense. It's certainty. It's what can guide everybody in dealing with these motions. I know that courts may feel burdened by sometimes by these types of motions, but the statute exists, and when a party has failed to engage in good faith settlement negotiations, and there is an indication that's a determination of good faith versus bad faith, it's not that at all. It's just whether there's been a failure to engage in good faith settlement negotiations. Then the trial court needs to consider that motion and consider the evidence that's been submitted by the parties. In this case, the evidence that was submitted, that was overwhelming upon a review of the record in terms of...
But the evidence, that's not the issue before us, is it? We're not going to determine whether somebody, you know, should have gotten prejudgment interest here. The legal issue is, was the trial court required by the statute to hold a hearing, whether it's a hearing in chambers with no one there, a hearing in chambers with lawyers there, or a full-blown hearing? None of that. Nothing happened. At least under 56C, the motion for summary judgment rule, it's related to time. The counsel knows what their time is to submit whatever they're going to submit. 1343-03 has none of that. It just says a hearing, as you know. It seems to me the Court of Appeals, the error it created here was it should have decided the trial court simply didn't do what the statute said it had to do, and remand the case to the trial court to do that. Isn't that the simple legal question before us?
Well, I don't think it's quite that simple, because in determining whether a court has abused its discretion...
Which court are we talking about?
The trial court's mission in this case, based upon the assignment of error and the opposition to that assignment of error, was to determine whether there was an abuse of discretion. And in making that determination, the Court of Appeals must, in fact, look at the record that was submitted to it by the parties.
But, counsel,
well, let me just finish. The first proposition of law is, the first assignment of error in the Court of Appeals is, whether the trial court erred by denying appellant's motion for prejudgment interest without conducting a hearing or providing any reasons for its ruling. Now, that's the legal question, is it not?
That was one of the two assignments of error.
The other one's discretion, whether they should have gotten prejudgment interest or not. We're not interested in that, are we? We don't decide factual issues here. We're interested in the legal issue, I think. That's what judges and lawyers need to know, is the next case that comes, can a trial court decide whether to grant prejudgment interest or not without giving anybody any notice of anything, you know, of a hearing? The statute says a hearing. That means something. Now, whether it means, you know, people in a courtroom with counsel representing them, or whether it means the judge deciding it in his or her chambers is the other question. But at least there has to be a hearing, doesn't there?
Well, I think that those are two different issues. I think under that first assignment of error, it'd be disingenuous for me to say that no, there shouldn't, that we didn't assert that as error. But the Court of Appeals specifically indicated that it wasn't reaching that issue, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, that's the legal issue it was supposed to reach, and and it didn't. It looked like it was pretty anxious to grant the prejudgment interest, frankly, from its opinion. It just skirted over the legal issue, and now we have it. Because it was anxious or whatever, it got to the factual issues, which really don't concern us.
Well, Your Honor, I think what you have here is a situation where that definition of what that hearing is can mean many different things.
Well, here it meant nothing. We all agree, don't we? It meant nothing here.
Well, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, because
you think the trial judge may have, in his chambers, just decided this and without telling anybody what he was doing. Is that?
I don't know what the trial judge did.
Could be a hearing,
I suppose.
Could be a hearing in the broadest sense of the term.
I can't tell you what he did in chambers.
No, I'm sure nobody can.
So I can tell you that he had before you ample evidence that was submitted by the Prusinskis, that he had opposition to the motion that was submitted by the defendants, that the defendants had every right to submit evidence c- contradicting the evidence submitted by the Prusinskis, that in fact what they did was submit very little evidence, if any evidence, because frankly there wasn't any, that if you looked at the facts of this particular case, I know this court doesn't want to look at this, the facts, but that's exactly why the prejudgment interest statute was adopted.
Well, counsel, on the hearing question, in the Court of Appeals, you argued there should have been something more than took place. What do you think the rule should be for the future? Because that's what your case is going to be about.
I think that the rule for the future should be that when a party files a motion for prejudgment interest and makes that prima facie case and meets the elements of the test set forth, the components of the test set forth in Moskowitz, that the court should conduct an oral evidentiary hearing unless by local rule it establishes that the motion will be submitted on briefs and evidence, affidavits, et cetera. I think that's the rule that should guide the courts in the future.
So what has to be done by both parties, spelled out either by rule or there's two lawyers, presumably,
Exactly, Your Honor.
Evidence in written or testimonial form presented.
Exactly. But that's going forward. On the facts of this particular case, I believe, and my clients strongly believe, that the Court of Appeals was correct in its decision, that the case should, in fact, be remanded for just the calculation of the amount of prejudgment interest, that this court perhaps should adopt rules to guide parties, their counsel, and trial judges.
Tell me why that rule shouldn't apply in this case. Usually when we apply a rule of law, sometimes it's prospective, but usually it's applied to the case before us. Why should it not be applied here? Because the Court of Appeals got it right, essentially, that...
Well, I could say that.
Must the be, court that of must appeals be your position, yeah.
The Court of Appeals got it right, but based upon the analysis that was conducted in terms of whether the Court of Appeals, or whether the trial court abused its discretion, and the arguments and of the parties in addressing that particular issue, that on the limited facts of this particular case, the motion for the Court of Appeals decision should stand, and that going forward, I think in the best practice for this court would be to adopt those bright line rules and guidelines for all parties. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Schlesinger, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Very briefly, one of the things that Mr. Potter mentioned was that the Court of Appeals had several options on what to do. One of those options was to remand the case back to the trial court, and we submit that that was the Court of Appeals' only option. Once it determined that an abuse of discretion occurred and that the Prusinskis had set forth a legitimate claim for prejudgment interest, they had to remand the case back to the trial court. One of the things Justice O'Donnell and I think Mr. Chief Justice mentioned as well was Civil Rule 56 and the term hearing as well. The term hearing in 56 not only anticipates but actually requires evidence to be submitted in support and opposition to a motion for summary judgment. Revised Code Section 1343.03c has no similar requirement.
Mr. Schlesinger, would you agree with the prospective rule that was proposed by Mr. Potter?
Respectfully, no. It certainly could help a bright line rule in terms of going forward on that every motion for prejudgment interest, a hearing is going to be held. I think, however, though, that would seriously bog down the trial courts. Again, we're dealing with a judge who sat through the pre-settlement discussions, who sat through the trial, and perhaps made up the decision already on whether or not the parties acted in good faith or bad faith. If a hearing was required on each and every motion for prejudgment interest that was filed, the courts are going to be bogged down, and perhaps it's just a practice at that point because the judge has already decided in his or her mind the motion's going to be denied. So I would not agree with that bright line rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schlesinger. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.